good to see the video of Michelle. Is that right? It's Michelle's video, isn't it? It's good. The best thing about that video is, you know, that moment where your son is coming up and talking to you, and then there's that cut in the video and he's disappeared. Wouldn't it be good if you can get that to happen in real life? Just that's great. I always have a little giggle. I don't want to see that one. And that life video, great. I mean, that's all the if you've been to life in the past, you'll know that a lot of the videos that show on at life used to be this really dated. This guy in a safari suit in the late 70s talking through the historical evidence. Yeah, and so we finally got around to reproducing those videos, and so they're great and they're really helpful. And I think we're going to get them to the stage where you'll be able to grab it on a DVD and even maybe give it to a friend or whatever. But that guy in the video, that's Disney Dan, by the way. Do you remember Disney Dan? Maybe the younger generation remember Disney Dan. He's bald now. Anyway, let's dive into the question for this week. So as you know, we're doing a series, Who Do You Think Jesus Is? And so a little disclaimer at the beginning here. What I'm about to do now is a bit different from what we normally do with the teaching week in, week out here. If you are new here, our bread and butter diet is to just take a passage of Scripture and work our way through it. But what we're doing over the next 4 weeks is we're attempting to answer responses that we got as we asked as many people as we could this question a few months ago: who do you think Jesus is? And so really I'm preaching next week as well. What I'll be doing particularly today is laying out evidence. And so some of it might come across a little bit different from a typical sermon. It might be a little bit more like a lecture. But you're up for that, aren't you, on a Sunday morning? I'll do my best to lay out some of this evidence, and there's so much of it, but I'm only going to lay out a little bit of it in a way that's helpful. But the question we're looking at, who do you think Jesus is, it's a fantastic question, and we would actually say that this would have to be this would have to be the most important question that a person can consider in their lifetime. And we would say that because Jesus is the man who claimed to be God, very clearly. And we'll be looking at that over the weeks as well. He's the man who claimed to be God. And so you need to decide what you think of him. You're stuck with a bit of a dilemma when there's a person standing in front of you claiming to be God. You need to decide what you think of them. In fact, the famous author C.S. Lewis actually said, you don't just have a dilemma, you've got a trilemma, meaning you've got three options to decide about this person if they're standing in front of you claiming to be God. You can decide one of three things. You can either choose to think that this guy's just a liar. He's just trying to trick people into thinking he's God, and he knows he's not, and he's not. Or he's the loony, yeah? He's lost his marbles, and he thinks he's God, but he's not. Or he actually is Lord. He actually is the God that he's claiming to be. And when Jesus claims to be God, it does require you and I to actually make a decision as to what we think of that. Unless, of course, he never existed. In which case, it doesn't matter what he apparently claimed about himself, because he's just a fictional character anyway. Yeah? And really, that's the response that we're dealing with this week. Did he even exist? Because a number of the people who we asked among our friends and family came back with the question, answered the question of who they think Jesus is by asking a question, which is, did he even exist? Is there any evidence for his existence? In fact, this response came sometimes in this form, where someone would ask their friend, and I know people who got this response, who do you think Jesus is? And the person would respond by saying, just your imaginary friend. You know, in the same category as Father Christmas and the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny. And maybe some of you got that as well when you asked your friends and family that question. Or maybe you're here today because that's honest, that is your question. Now, I think that response has come from some people in a bit of a silly fashion, perhaps wanting to be dismissive of the question or even defensive because the question has been asked to them. But there are others, no doubt, for whom it's a genuine response. It's a genuine question. You know, when they're asked who they think Jesus is, they genuinely think, well, I'm not sure that he even existed. Now, why is it that people these days have that as a genuine question, wondering really whether Jesus even did exist? Well, the stacks of things, information in what you might call the popular media these days, which actually aim to cast a shadow of doubt over the existence of Jesus. And I'll just mention a few of them. A lot of the more popular new atheists, and they're modern atheists. They're not the traditional atheists. They're modern atheists. They're cooler, and they write shorter books, and a lot more people can read them. And here's a few of them. So you've got Michael Onfray, you've got Shelby Spong, you've got Richard Dawkins is probably one of the most popular atheists at the moment, him and Christopher Hitchens. And when you see the title of Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, it's pretty clear the thesis of his book. He's wanting to suggest that this whole God thing is just a delusion that we've made up in our minds. In fact, I'll quote from his book. Dawkins actually quotes a professor from London University. And in looking at what the professor says, he says, a serious historical case can be made that Jesus never lived at all. This is what Dawkins says in his book. And so many who read Dawkins' book think, oh, okay, well, maybe it is just been made up. One little problem is the professor that Dawkins quotes from the University of London is not a professor in ancient history. He's a professor in German. So probably not an expert in the field that he's speaking into just there. It's G.A. Wells that he quotes. Now, as well as books that are going around, and a lot of people don't even read easy-to-read books these days, but people will watch telly. And you only need to flick on SBS or the Discovery Channel and see documentaries. And there are dime a dozen out there that'll grab claims from books like this and evidence from here and there and make suggestions that Jesus never existed. So all you got to do is flick on a documentary these days, and there'll be plenty that will cast a shadow of doubt over even the existence of Jesus, that perhaps he was just a character of fiction that we've made up over time. Now, I want to give you a quick comeback, or a quick response to that suggestion, and then a more extended one. The quick one goes like this. It was actually suggested by a fellow named Alistair McGrath, and John Dixon used it recently when he was on Q&A. I'm not sure if you can take that one off now, otherwise we'll keep looking at that and studying those books. I'm not sure if you ever watched Q&A, but John Dixon was on that recently with a bunch of atheists, one of them being the American physicist and mathematician Lawrence Krauss, his name is. And while that discussion was happening, Jesus was spoken of in the same category as the Tooth Fairy and Father Christmas, in the same sentence. It's just a fictitious character. John Dixon pipes up with a very quick and I think helpful response, and that is this. He says, when was the last time you saw a reasonable thinking adult start to believe in the Tooth Fairy? Because what we see is reasonable thinking adults start to believe in Jesus all the time. Now, that's just a really helpful observation to make. You know, kids might believe in Santa and the Tooth Fairy, and I don't know, too many young kids here today. I've always had that moment. I've done it before. I'm sorry, Angela, if I've just broken the news to you there, mate. Okay. But tell me someone who's come to believe in the Tooth Fairy as an adult. You don't see it, but you do see sane, intelligent, reasonable adults coming to believe in Jesus all the time, all around the world. And you see, adults, when they come to believe in something, usually what an adult needs is solid proof. That's what adults need. And here's the deal, when you come looking for evidence for the existence of Jesus, the evidence is actually overwhelming if you care to look for the existence of Jesus. And to give a little example of how the evidence is overwhelming, I'll quote John Dixon again. And the reason why I quote John Dixon is because he's a local boy, but when I say a local boy, that's probably a bit derogatory. He's a professor in ancient history at Macquarie University. He's also a Christian and a pastor, but he's a recognised professor in ancient history and engages in discussion with other professors in ancient history globally in different universities. He put out a challenge, and we shared this with you probably a couple of years ago when he first put the challenge out, so maybe some of you remember it, but John Dixon put out a challenge via Twitter and Facebook that went like this. If anyone can find a recognised professor in ancient history who claims that Jesus never existed, I will eat a page of my Bible. Yeah, do you remember when that? That was 2 years ago. He put out that claim, put out that challenge. He'd eat a page of his Bible. Now it did really go global because it was retweeted by a bunch of famous people, including John Safran, the kind of comedian documentary guy. And so it really did get out there. And so there's been actually hundreds of responses, maybe even thousands of responses, suggestions of professors around the world. But none to this day have been professors in ancient history recognised by a university. There's been professors in German, and that's nice, but no professors in ancient history. So 2 years on, John has still yet to eat a page of his Bible, still hungry for his Bible page, yeah? And why is that? Why is it that even after 2 years asking that question globally, we still cannot find one professor in ancient history who would even suggest that Jesus didn't exist? It's because the evidence for his existence is overwhelming. And I want to look at some of the evidence this morning. I want you to get a glimpse of it. And if it really is overwhelming, I'm not going to be able to do it justice. So what I'm going to attempt to do is just give you a taste, a snippet. And this is what you might call the extended response. This isn't the quick comeback, this is the extended comeback. If someone really wants to look at the evidence, and I'm going to trust that some of you here this morning are interested in this, and even those of you who have had a faith in Jesus for a long time, what is important to get is historical evidence that actually backs up your faith. So you can answer questions as they're put to you, and that can strengthen your faith as well. So I trust that that is what will happen today. And I want to present the evidence just in two forms. Number one, I do want to present the evidence from the Bible for the existence of Jesus. Now you might say, well, of course the Bible's going to suggest Jesus existed. The Bible's all about Jesus. It is. But before I actually go to the Bible, I do actually want to explain why the Bible is a legitimate source for historical evidence. I'll do that before we go to the Bible, because this is used as a legitimate source of history by ancient historians in universities around the world. And I'll talk about that before we go there. But before we even get to the Bible, I want to talk about evidence outside of the Bible. Yeah? External evidence, you might call it. Because if Jesus is a true historical figure, you ought to expect to find evidence outside of this. We ought to be able to find evidence everywhere else outside of the Bible, and we do. So what kind of evidence do we go looking for? How do you decide for sure whether someone was a historical figure that lived 2,000 years from now? We can't go looking for file footage, yeah? There were no video cameras or iPhones. And even if there were, I was thinking, you produce a picture of Jesus or a video of Jesus, and what will everyone say about it anyway? Just, it's been fabricated, yeah? And that's, you know, we watch movies these days and we know how they've been. They're so easily fabricated and people have been put in. So actually, file footage probably wouldn't be as helpful as what is in existence, which is, I'll mention two broad categories of evidence, artifacts that have been dug up by archaeological digs, and literature that we've discovered from very early first century. We'll look at those two areas, and I'll try not to put you to sleep here, but this is really important things to look at. We'll start with artifacts, and really there are hundreds of artifacts from the first century that would support the existence of the historical figure of Jesus. Let me give you two. I'm going to talk about a box of bones, which has already come up on the screen, and I'm going to talk about a mosaic. Let's talk about this box of bones first. It's called an ossuary box. And it was discovered about 10 years ago in 2002 by a fellow who initially didn't think it was that significant until we had a good look at the inscription on the side of the box. Now, this box was used to store the bones of a person who died quite a while ago. This was a common practice in the first century. Once your relatives were dead for quite some time and they were just reduced to bones, the most effective way to store your relatives was to gather those bones from the tomb, pop them in a little box, put them on the shelf. It's a nice, tidy way to store all your relatives. Very efficient, space saving. Yeah. So that's what we did back in the day. This is a limestone box, and you'd put an inscription on the side of the box whose bones they were, just so we can remember, of course, right? Now the inscription on the side of the box is actually, you probably can't quite see it, but even if you could see it, it's in Aramaic, so you probably can't read it. But here's what it says in Aramaic. It says, James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. Now, initially, when that inscription was heralded and put out in the public, everyone thought, nah, it's a fraud. Couldn't be. And so the fellow who actually presented this box has actually been going through a court case for fraud for the last 10 years. last year, 2012, they wrapped up the court case and released him from any fraudulent charges, which is to say they're pretty confident that there was no fraud involved, in, particularly in the inscription on the side of this box. Now, that doesn't mean it's definitely what it says it is. It might be another James from the first century who happened to have a dad named Joseph and a brother named Jesus. It might be that. But most ancient archaeologists are pretty confident that this is the James of the Bible with the brother Jesus and a father Joseph, the historical figure. And so it's widely held as very confident that this is the box that holds James's bones. Now you go on the net and Google this one, and no doubt there are still skeptics who exist who suggest that it's not. But look at what the experts are saying, and they are quite confident that it is. So there's just one piece of archaeological evidence, one artifact that would suggest the existence of Jesus and James. Yeah, I'll give you another one. Here's a mosaic, and this mosaic was discovered in Israel, funnily enough, in the prison, the Megiddo prison. Yeah, and the prisoners were actually working to excavate the prison and broaden it a little bit, as they do. You know, they go dig in tunnels from time to time, and it was a legit amount of digging. And as they dug, they actually discovered these ancient ruins of a first century village. And in this village was a quite large house, which had actually been shaped, they believe, into the very first New Testament church, or the earliest New Testament church that we've ever come across. As early as like late 100s, even maybe early 200 AD. And in this church, the floor, which is more, it's like a big house church, really, effectively, the floor was mosaic tiles, one of beautiful mosaic tiles with inscriptions in those tiles all the way through it. And this particular inscription says this. Again, if you could read Greek, you could see this. It says, "To God, Jesus Christ." Okay? Now, you might think, okay, what's so significant about that? I want to give you the significance. A criticism that's been leveled at the church is that Christians never really started to worship Jesus as God until about mid-300s, and particularly the Council of Nicaea, where apparently all the bigwigs of the church gathered around and decided, from now on, we're going to recognize Jesus was God. And so the criticism that's leveled at the church is, it's early on Jesus' followers didn't worship him as God, but later on the church just kind of decided in hindsight, yeah, let's say he's God and worship him as God now. And that kind of has been propagated by through Dan Brown's book, Da Vinci Code. He was right into that, and the movie that came from that. And so a lot of people say, the church just made it up that Jesus was God. But this evidence smashes that theory, that suggestion, because this is... there's 100 or 150 years prior to the Council of Nicaea, clear evidence that the followers of Jesus worshipped him as God from a very early time. Now, as we dig up these things, time and time again, we actually see that archaeological discovery... I'm looking for my phone because I had another quote. It's all right, it's up there. I found another quote from the head of archaeology at Cambridge, I think it was, where he was just talking generally, archaeological artifacts that are dug up do nothing but give us confidence in the details that we find in the Bible, that they're legit. So there's a couple of artifacts. Anyone bored or asleep yet? Going all right? We'll just keep going? We've got so much more, but I'll just get... There's two artifacts for you. Now let's look at some literature. And when I say literature, I'm talking about writings outside of the Bible, written by people who are not followers of Jesus, so no vested interest in mentioning Jesus or making him out to be good, and some of them don't make him out to be good at all, but they mention him as a historical figure in the first century. Now, here's a list of a lot of the early writings that ancient historians discuss. I just saw someone yawn. Yeah, I'm yawning too. And here's a list of them. Now, you may not recognize many of those names. The earlier writers are the more significant ones because they're considered to be more reliable and more accurate. I'm just going to pull out two of those writers and show you a quote from two of them. We'll start with Tacitus, who is considered a very early writer. Go to the next slide. I've got a picture of him. Look at that. There's Tacitus. He looks all right, doesn't he? He's considered ancient Rome's greatest historian. And in one of his writings, The Annals of Imperial Rome, which is written at about 115 AD, he records all the details of the emperors, Nero, Tiberius, and his writings basically form the basis of much of our understanding of what happened in that era, particularly Roman history. And as he writes and records the emperors and their actions, and particularly their persecution on Christians, he describes the persecution of Christians and the existence of Jesus, and it's worth noting. So here's one quote from one of his... You can go to that next slide there, Roy. There you go. Here's Nero, one of the emperors. To suppress the rumour, he falsely charged with the guilt and punished Christians who were hated for their enormities. Christus, that's Christ, yeah, the founder of the name, was put to death by Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judah in the region of Tiberias. Now, that's just a passing comment, but it's a passing comment from a recognized historian for Rome who mentions very confidently the existence of Christians who followed Christ, who was crucified, executed by Pontius Pilate. Now, that just rings true with the details that we get in Scripture, okay? And it just gels with what we have in the Bible. Okay, this guy is obviously not a fan of Jesus or a fan of Christians, but he mentions them as historical figures. So ancient historians believe Jesus to have existed because they got confidence in writings like this. Okay, let me give you someone else. This is a Jewish historian, the next fellow, Josephus. He's far more popular. Most people have heard of Josephus before. And he writes even earlier than Tacitus. He writes around the time of, one of his writings is around 80 AD. That's super early, super close to the events of Jesus' life. And in his writing, The Antiquity of the Jews, he mentions Jesus a number of times, and he actually mentions Jesus quite favorably, although never became a follower of Jesus himself, remained a Jew. But look at what he writes about Jesus. Here's one of the areas. Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man. For he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at first did not forsake him. For he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct to this day. So there's a non-following Jewish historian, not just mentioning the existence of Jesus, but details about his life, his followers, his death, his resurrection. Yeah? And the tribe that exists. We are the tribe. We're the existing tribe 2,000 years later. Okay. So this is literature outside of the Bible, written by non-followers of Christ, just testifying to the existence of Jesus. In fact, if you gather together all that is said about the historical figure of Jesus and the details of his life, written by people outside of the Scriptures, you come up with a list like this. Here's the next slide. Here are the facts that are confirmed outside the Bible about Jesus. You get when he lived, where he lived, that he was an influential teacher, that he did things considered supernatural, that he was executed, when and by whom, that he had a brother named James, that people claimed he was raised from the dead, and that he was known by the title Christ. All this confirmed outside of Scripture. So that ancient historians are incredibly confident that Jesus not only existed, but they've got the details of his life before you even get to the Bible. So there's some of the evidence that's out there. Which means this, anyone who does want to attempt to suggest that Jesus never really existed is not really looking. Yeah. So when Richard Dawkins, someone who claims to be an academic, makes a claim quoting a German professor, the guy's been silly, nothing short of silly, to make that kind of suggestion. In fact, I think you've got to have your eyes shut really tightly to not see any evidence for the existence of Jesus. It's overwhelming. I'm just giving you a snippet of it. But now I want to go to the Bible and talk about the Bible, obviously providing evidence for the existence of Jesus. But as we come to the Bible, I want to start by asking that question, why is it that we can consider this to be an accurate record of history? Because ancient historians do consider it to be a very accurate, detailed record of history. Why? Why do historians consider it that way? What do historians look for in any document to discuss whether it's accurate and reliable? Well, I'll give you three things, and I'll mention, and I'll dig into one of them just particularly. One of the big things that, you can probably go to the next slide, it's blank, yeah, that's good. One of the big things that historians look for to test the accuracy of any kind of document is they'll look for this. How far out from the original events was it written? Was the original writing written? That's one of the big things that they want to see. The second thing they want to see is, because often the original writings don't exist anymore when you're talking 2,000 years ago, all we're left with is copies of the original. So the second body of evidence they're looking for is, how far off from the originals were the copies written? And how many copies have we got? And what kind of discrepancy is there between the copies? So there's those two bodies of evidence that historians look for. Are you with me on this one? I want to look at this one, this first one, and then this second one as well. And stick with me on this, it's worth following me. This first one, how far out from the events of Jesus do we see the first writings, the first records of the events of Jesus' life? Well, when historians look at the distance, they consider it to be extremely close compared to, relative to, many of the other writings we have in regards to other historical figures. And let me just give you a few examples and then kind of bring them relative to each other. Consider the historical figure Tiberius Caesar. And no one doubts Tiberius Caesar existed, yeah? No one even makes a suggestion that he didn't. And yet the first writings that we have about Tiberius Caesar were written 180 years after the events of his life. But when historians get those writings, they consider that to be very close, actually, and highly reliable writings about the life of Tiberius Caesar. Consider another figure with me, Alexander the Great. Does anyone want to cast a shadow of doubt over the existence of Alexander the Great? I've never met anyone. And yet the first writings that we have, the original writings that we have in regards to his life, are written 430 years after the events of his life. And yet again, historians still consider that to be reasonably close, and they're quite confident that the details written, even 430 years after the event of his life, are pretty accurate. Now consider Jesus. How far out from the events of Jesus' life were the first writings? 60 years. Within 60 years of the events of Jesus' life, we have four detailed biographies of Jesus' life. And historians consider that to be extremely close. You don't get anything like that in any other biographies. Extremely close. And when I talk biographies, I'm talking about the four Gospels that we have in the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Three of them are eyewitness accounts, and the fourth one, written by Luke, is actually, Luke's actually a careful historian himself, who goes out there and investigates the details, interviews eyewitnesses, gathers the information, writes it all down, and actually presents an orderly account to a Roman official named Theophilus. That's what Luke does. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are these biographies of Jesus' life, which are written so remarkably close to the life of Jesus that they could have been refuted because there still would have been eyewitnesses present if when they presented their works. So they're considered incredibly accurate. So there's the first body of evidence, the original writings. Second body of evidence, I don't have any slides for that first lot. I do have slides for this second lot though, and see if you can follow me with the second one, because this is a different category at all. We're talking about now the copies of the originals, right? You don't? Yeah, that's okay. You can have that up. So here's the first example, and we're talking about different historical figures now, so we're moving to a different body of evidence, okay? When you consider someone like Plato, the manuscripts, the copies that we have from the original documents, well, actually he wrote his own original documents because he was a philosopher, so it's a little bit different for him. But the copies that we have from Plato, the first copies that we have, are about 1,200 years after the original writings of Plato. Okay, and we've only got about seven manuscripts, copies of the original writings of Plato that are discovered 1,200 years out. But historians consider that to be quite good. Now consider Caesar with me. The first writings, the first copies of Caesar, and this is a different Caesar, so it might be slightly different. The first copies that we have of the writings about Caesar discovered about 1,000 years after the original writings, and we've got about 10 of those copies. Yeah? And again, that's pretty good. That's pretty good, what they call manuscript evidence. There's copies and there's not a lot of discrepancy between those copies. Now again, let's come and consider Jesus and the writings of the New Testament. The first copies that we have are 30 years after the originals were written. And we have a fragment of John's Gospel. Yeah? Not the original, but a fragment of the copy of John's Gospel. 30 years after. That's phenomenal. But then look at what happens in the next 200 years. Look at what we discover in the next 200 years. We've got 10 copies of the New Testament. And I say they're the whole New Testament. Because what happened in the early days is a gospel would be passed around between local churches, and as it would come to your local church, you would get your local scribe to make a copy of that document for yourself, and then you would pass on that biography of Jesus' life to other local churches. And so what would happen over time is every local church would build up their own little library of the gospels and the letters, which came known as the New Testament. It was rubber stamped later on in history, but early on, what we discover as we dig up in the first 200 years of history, we actually see these entire libraries of the New Testament preserved in different regions around Asia Minor, and the discrepancy between them is just minuscule. And so, again, ancient historians are just blown away by the fact that they find so many copies so early. But then look what happens over the next 1,000 years. You get thousands of manuscripts. Like, historians actually don't know what to do with this many copies of manuscripts. It's so overwhelming. It basically says this: there is nothing, there is no book in history that has legitimate evidence for accuracy like the Bible. What this means is not only were the original writings of the New Testament really reliable, but the copies of the originals, in other words, how it was transmitted over the years, is highly reliable and authentic. Some people will say, well, but do what we have in our hand now, has it been changed over time? Surely Chinese whispers just changes everything. No. The transmission through the ages has been phenomenally accurate. All that to say, you can have incredible confidence that the Bible that you have in your hand in 2013 is incredibly accurate to the original writing, and the original writing is so close to the original event that that is incredibly reliable as well. So what we have here, ancient historians, professors in ancient history around the world, whether they're Christians or not, will all go to the Bible, to the New Testament, to see this as an incredibly accurate textbook for history. You can count on the Bible to be accurate in the details of what it records. So we'll have a little break from that at the moment. Does anyone need to stretch their legs? Are you going okay? Feeling hot? Doing all right? I want to actually go into the Bible now and look at some of the details that the Bible suggests, because if this is true, if everything I've just been saying is true, it just points to the reliability of the Bible. And if that's the case, we've got to see what the Bible's got to say. Yeah? We've got to look at the Bible itself. Well, come and look at just those two passages, one in Luke and one in John there. And if you don't have a Bible, let us know and we'll get you one. We'll even get you a free copy of Luke's Gospel if you need one, so that you can read it for yourself. Come on, we'll look there in Luke chapter 1, verse 1. And remember, Luke is the historian who records this biography. And look what he says himself about his own biography. He says, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us." So he acknowledges many have done what he has done here. Many have wanted to record biographies about the life of Jesus, because the life of Jesus is actually huge news in the ancient world, and it has highly significant events for everyone. And so many have attempted to draw up an account. A lot of those other accounts were drawn up by eyewitnesses, which he mentions in verse 2, just as they were handed down to us by those who were from the first eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Okay, so many of those who drew up accounts were actually eyewitnesses. Matthew, Mark, John, all eyewitnesses of Jesus. Highly reliable, highly verifiable. But Luke himself, verse 3, tells us how he did his. "With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that have been taught." So Luke does his own careful investigation, interviewing eyewitnesses, recording it all, presenting it to this Roman official, Theophilus, with a purpose. And his purpose is there in verse 4. Luke is very clear about why he's He's gone to all this effort to record the details of Jesus' life, and it's not just because he wants to be an academic and get a PhD, it's because he wants Theophilus 2, verse 4, so that you may know the certainty of these things you've been taught. Everyone in the ancient world would have heard about Jesus and at some level been taught about the events of Jesus' life. But Luke writes so that people would know the certainty of the events. And it's important that we get confirmation about the accuracy and certainty of these events, because the events are so breathtaking and incredible and impacting that you want to know they're true. And so Luke writes so that this guy Theophilus and all readers of his biography would know the certainty of these events. Now, you might be hearing this morning and you may have thought this before, and you might find yourself thinking, well, look, when you see all the evidence outside the Bible and in the Bible, you see evidence for the existence of Jesus, you might think, why doesn't everyone just acknowledge the existence of Jesus and his life and much of what was claimed about him? Here's my guess, and it's just a guess, it's a hunch. You tell me if you think I'm close to it. If the evidence is really that overwhelming, I'm going to suggest this. People are not really wanting to acknowledge the evidence, because they know that if they do acknowledge the evidence, then they're going to have to figure out what they think about Jesus. Yeah? They're going to have to figure out what to do with Jesus. They're going to need to decide whether they think he's liar, lunatic, or Lord. They're going to have to really figure out whether they think he did rise from the dead, whether he is who he claimed to be. And Jesus made some extraordinary claims about himself. So if you acknowledge it as a real historical figure, you've got to figure out what you're going to do with the claims he makes. Let me give you a glimpse of the claims that he makes, and we're going to look at more of this next week. Jesus, John records in his biography a lot of the claims that Jesus makes in a very similar format. You can call them the I am statements of Jesus, where Jesus says, I am this, I am that, and let me mention some of them. Jesus says, I am the bread of life. Come to me, you'll never hunger. Believe in me, you'll never thirst. I am the light of the world. Follow me, you'll never walk in darkness. You'll have the light of life. I am the resurrection and the life. Believe in me, and though you die, you will live again. I am the way, the truth, and the life. Not a way, a truth, a life. No, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, the life. No one gets to God except through me. Now, that's controversial these days, and it was controversial back then when he first said it. Those who heard him making such claims heard exactly what he was suggesting about himself, and many were infuriated that he was suggesting that he, in fact, was God. And so time and time again, there were attempts to have him assassinated, usually by people picking up stones and wanting to throw them at him until he was dead. Yeah, stonings were common in the first century, and people continually wanted to kill him because they could hear very clearly that he was claiming to be God. Jesus makes extraordinary claims about himself. And if he was a real historical figure, you need to decide what you think about him. Because if he is who he claims to be, then that's actually going to call for a personal response from every single one of us, every person who exists. And I think this is why many don't want to look at the evidence, don't want to have to consider the claims, because they know it's going to mean change. I actually think for many people, and tell me if this is you this morning, I think it's easier not to look. And I think people don't want to look because they know that if they do look, they're going to see a man, a historical man, claiming to be God with a claim on their life, and that's going to mean consequence. That's going to mean possible disruption. And so it's far easier to dismiss this Jesus figure so you don't have to consider him and you get to avoid the inconvenience that might come with the consequences for acknowledging him to be who he is. And so I think that's actually probably what's going on for many people. Not looking because I don't want to look, because they're afraid of what they might find and the change that might come. It's like this. I'll give you an example. From a young age, I was always fascinated about how my mum could find things and see things that I could never see and find. Yeah, you ever notice the difference between mum eyes and little boy eyes? Yeah. I always, you know, I would say, "Mum, where are my shoes? You know, I'm looking in a spot. I thought they were here, and I'm just looking in one spot, you know." And mum, boy eyes, yeah. And mum would just seem to have this X-ray vision or something like that, where she would just know where things are. She'd see through cupboards. They're in the cupboard, you know. So I grew up thinking, wow, mums have this incredible ability to look and see things. But then when I grew up, I realised it's not just a mum, little boy thing. I think it's a difference between male eyes and female eyes, yeah. You going to agree with me there? There you go. A little nudge just going on. Male and female eyes. Because now as I acknowledge my daughter and my wife, I think they see things too that I just can't see. I go looking for things, you know, I just can't find them. It's hilarious. Now, but you got to ask, well, why can't I find them? So here's my consideration. Let's say this happened in my household. And of course this would never happen in my house, but let's just pretend it did. My wife is in the next room and I see that one of my children has managed to fill his pants with like something horrendous, right? And it needs to be changed. And so I call out to Deb. Deb, you know, Joey needs his nappy changed. She calls back to me, get the nappy and the wipes. And I say, well, where are they? I wouldn't know, would I? She says, they're in the cupboard. So I go to the cupboard, I open the cupboard. I'm looking, I can't see them. I call out to Deb, they're not there. And she goes, they are there. And I say, they're not there. Now, what could be happening for me right then in that moment? It might be that it's not there. It might be that it's a different colour and shape than what I'm expecting it to be, in which case I'll never find it. You know, I think it's something with male eyes. If it's not what I'm expecting it to be on the front shelf of the fridge, I can't look for it anymore, right? But it could very well be that I don't really want to look, because if I do look, I might find the nappy and the wipes. And if I find the nappy of wipes, then I know what I'm in for. There's going to be consequence. I'm going to need to deal with this nappy, and it's been 12 years and I'm really struggling. I think it's time for it all to end, right? Although I shouldn't complain. Deb's changed far more nappies than me. But do you see the point? Like sometimes we don't want to look because we don't really want to find, because we know there's going to be consequence to finding. And I don't want to deal with those consequences. Now that's kind of a funny, trivial example, but I actually think that's what's very well maybe going on generally in our society. People don't want to look. People don't want to look at evidence for Jesus because they don't want to find evidence for Jesus, because they know that finding evidence for Jesus is going to mean consequence, because he may very well be the God he claimed to be, and that's going to mean a claim on my life. That's going to mean consequence. That's going to mean change. And you might be here this morning thinking, yeah, I think that's why I've always avoided the evidence. I think that's why I've always tried to grab onto the shadow of doubt that gets cast over it, because it's easier to just dismiss it. Whatever you do, don't look at the evidence for Jesus with male eyes. Can I put it like that? I can make this generalization because I am a male, okay? Look with female eyes. Look long and hard. You don't actually need to look long and hard to see incredible evidence, but look, find, let the consequence roll. Come to that second passage, and I'll wrap up on this. Come to John chapter 20, which is just further over, or if you're looking at that piece of paper, it's just that next little chunk there. And John, just like Luke, is super clear about the purpose for which he writes. Yeah? Luke says, I want Theophilus, I want you to know the certainty. Yeah? John puts it slightly differently. Pick it up there in verse 30. Where John writes, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. And then verse 31, here's his purpose. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John goes to the trouble of writing this biography, again, not just to be an academic, but because he wants his readers to believe that this is real. Believe that Jesus is a historical character. But not just that. John wants his readers to believe something particular about Jesus. He writes this, that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, which means the long-awaited king who comes to save. We're going to look at that more next week. He wants people to believe that and see that Jesus is Son of God, truly divine. And ultimately, he wants people to believe so that they might have life in his name. That's what comes with belief. and acknowledgement of Jesus and true trust in him, life in his name. Now, friends, it is true that what comes with belief, that to believe means, it will mean acknowledging sin, your own sin. It will mean, to believe does mean to turn away from sin and turn to Christ and acknowledge him as Lord and come under him as King. That is what belief means. And I think that is the hard thing that many want to avoid, coming under Christ in a life of submission to him. And belief does mean bringing yourself under him. But what you get by believing in Jesus far outweighs any cost. Yeah? And actually, the cost is a wonderful thing as well. Because what you get by believing is life in his name. You get life. The very thing, belief, the very thing that is confronting and sometimes hard to accept is also the very thing that will bring you life. And life eternal. Yeah? These documents of the New Testament are reliable, trustworthy historical documents. They present to us the historical figure of Jesus, who makes extraordinary claims about himself, which must be considered. If you're yet to consider them, look, consider, wrestle, knowing that they're written so that you might do that and then find yourself trusting and believing and getting life for eternity. Yeah. If you are new to these things or you're still wrestling with these things, I do want to do everything I can to encourage you to look. In fact, I'd even say it like this, I dare you to look. I double dare you to consider the evidence. A physical challenge, you know, I don't know what that might be, but what can I do to urge you to look and see Jesus and get life? Join us for the next few weeks where we'll be digging into this character even more and more and more. And friends, bring your friends to hear this. Let me pray. Father God, we're grateful for your testimony to us through history. We're so grateful for the incredible evidence of the reality of your involvement with us through time. We're so grateful for historical evidence that's just overwhelming to support the claims that you have come to us in the person of Jesus. Lord, would you enable us and others to look long and hard at the evidence and to see you and believe? And Lord, would you enable that to be the case so that people see what life is about and we get life in your name? Amen.